Steve, what is the Bhopal Stiffs?
What is the Bhopal Stiffs? It's a product of society. It's a cry for help. It's a need for attention. Boredom is the reason. It's a lot of things. It's being young and angry and angsty and but not wanting to be that way, and it's just a whole lot of things.
Welcome to episode 17 of Jughead's Basement, featuring the Chicago suburban-based band Bhopal Stiffs. This episode will not be based on a single record, but from a compilation of songs in order of release from their demo, two EPs, and the single compilation they were on called A Fungus Among Us. Bhopal Stiffs began in the west suburbs of Chicago in 1985 and quickly became a favorite punk band around a few scattered punk hangouts and bars in Chicago. While Ben and I were discovering what Screeching Weasel was in the north suburbs of Chicago, on the west side a similar brewing of punk talents was happening with the Bhopal Stiffs. Both bands ventured into the big city and began playing shows at a 21 and over club called Batteries Not Included. At this place and a couple other venues scattered around the area is where we would meet for the first times the likes of Joey Vindictive, Dan Vapid, Glenn Herman, Russ Forrester, Jim Ellison, and Mark Ruvalo. You may not recognize all these names, but they would all have a part in keeping punk alive in the underground scene, bridging the gap between city and suburbs in the late 80s and the early 90s in and around Chicago. Bhopal Stiffs was a crucial part in this bridge between Chicago bands such as the Effigies and Naked Raygun and the pop-punk scene to soon emerge. Their sound and attitudes made it easier for bands such as Screeching Weasel to be accepted by the big boys of punk living in the depth of the rough and tumble city. They were a powerhouse of a band with two hulking frontmen singing and playing guitar with a concentrated rhythm section that allowed the two wrestlers up front to crush their guitars and their big paws to force their sound down the throats of an audience who stood in awe. They were my introduction to how powerful and visceral punk rock could be, and that is why I am proud to be featuring them on Jughead's Basement. This podcast will feature interviews with the four core members of Bhopal Stiffs, Larry D'Amore, Vince Marine, David Schleitweiler, and Steve Sailors. And now I present to you the Chicago powerhouse punk band known as the Bhopal Stiffs. You just listened to Road to Bhopal from the 1988 release EPA on Roadkill Records, a label funded by David Best and run by me and Ben Foster. The following eight songs you will hear are from Bhopal Stiffs' self-released 10-song demo released in 1987. Out of all the demo tapes I have collected from fledgling punk bands in the mid-80s, this was by far my favorite. All of these songs, plus the rest of their small catalog of songs, would later be released in 2001 by Harmless Records on a CD simply called Bhopal Stiffs, 1985 to 1989. P.S. I have added into this program sound bites from news and entertainment that was going on between the years 85 and 88. These were not on the specific recordings by Bhopal Stiffs. I added them to help give context to the time period. Larry and Vince were the main writers for the band, and each song is introed by the writer of that particular song, starting now. So here is Vince with track one, Born Again.
Born Again was written, of course these songs were from the 80s, and that was kind of a reaction to the religious right at the time, who was people like Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson, who were imposing their religious view in politics, Republican politics. And I think that's one of the few songs that holds up pretty well today, considering Sarah Palin and Huckabee and those guys. So it pretty much stands up, and the views that are expressed in that song, I still hold to this day.
That one, what you just said there, Vince, reminds me of Adrenaline OD talked about Jerry Falwell, too. It was a big thing in the 80s because it was on, I think it was on TV. So all of us, when we were kids, we were very familiar with watching those crazy fundamentalist Christians on TV.
Yeah, and, you know, when me and Larry, we spent a year at Illinois State, and late nights we would watch Jim and Tammy. And, that had quite an effect on us, too. I just couldn't believe that people would actually send that guy money or even listen to anything that they said.
Me and Ben almost ordered the, you could buy a little vial of holy water, I think, from Jerry Falwell or one of those guys. I can't remember which. The one that spoke in tongues on TV.
Yeah. And things haven't really changed all that much.
No.
Want to hear what God says and take it, mix it with faith. I sound like I'm getting a little pastoral right now. Somata sidi dala moko, manda kishiti kolora bashata, manda kalaboho masiki lomoko damasa, kadita na mosoya lama, kamba sokoya. For I would say unto you this day, saith the Lord.
So right from the beginning, David, where were you born and raised?
I was born in Berwyn at the Berwyn Hospital. I was raised in LaGrange Park, Illinois, probably about 25 minutes from downtown Chicago by highway.
Oh, yeah. So you were, so that's west side. And because basically me and Ben were on the northwest side about the same distance away. So we were securely planted in the suburban areas. Steve, where were you born and raised?
I actually was born in the western suburbs in LaGrange and grew up in Brookfield and met up with the other guys just out of high school. I would say maybe a couple years out of high school. I had already been playing in a few bands.
I see you want to tackle way too much at once. I'm taking it slow here.
Okay. No, you need to tell me that. Absolutely, man.
Yeah, don't mention the Bhopals until there's a point where I get to that, so...
Okay.
Always know that you're not supposed to be there until I say the word Bhopal. Larry DeMore.
I was born and raised in a town, a suburb of Chicago called Riverside, and pretty much grew up there my whole life. It's probably about right outside of Chicago, about 12 miles outside of Chicago. I mean, I was close enough that I could, when I got turned on to all that type of music, it was easy enough for me to get down there and be part of it. Literally a 5-minute drive from the Chicago border. So it was really like one of the first suburbs outside of the city.
We were a little bit farther out. I think on the northwest side, we were knee deep in the suburbs.
Yeah, I've been out there.
Vince?
I was born in Broadview, Illinois, and raised in Brookfield. Went to Riverside Brookfield High School.
Pretty much all of you are all in the same area, close to the city, but still considered a suburb, right?
Yeah, near west suburb. We could hop on the L and take it into the city. But the L would stop in Berwyn. We'd have to take a bus to the L, and then we'd get downtown from there.
Yeah, I bring that up because I think I'm going to try to touch in this podcast about Weasel and about Bhopal both coming from the suburbs, but you guys were a little bit more like Chicago city savvy than we were. We were a little bit farther out there, about 35 minutes, I think.
Yeah, we occasionally got into the city, but we're pretty suburban.
Yeah.
Don't come back another day. Don't give a fuck to believe. And do it well to your man.
There are a couple questions I consistently ask on this program, and one of my favorites that resonates with why I do this podcast is asking bands where they think the artistic leaning in themselves may have derived from. I am fully aware that this is not an exact science, and the interviewees may be searching for something only to answer my question, but what is more important to me, and so is an aspect of this podcast's propensity to explore the effects of the past on us today, is what comes into the mind of a musician when posed this question. Who, or what, is on their minds now when they reflect on who they are now? I feel my connection with this band, Bhopal Stiffs, is personal, and so I thought I'd share that with you, the listener, in hopes that maybe you reflect on your own lineage and its effect on you. On drums, David.
My father was a stand-up bass player in Chicago. He played in many bands and his own as well. Jazz is what he played. And going back to my uncle plays keyboard, and my other uncle played keyboard in my father's band. So yes, there is definitely music in my family.
Did you get to see your father play often?
I used to practice with my dad in the living room, actually. He'd play bass, and then my other uncle would play keyboard, and so we kind of would jam together as a family.
Steve on bass.
I would say I definitely take after my mom. She's got the musical ear, and she likes to paint, draw and paint, and she strums a guitar, and she's just really active, and so I definitely take after her. But I've always, I can never remember not having music in my life.
Do you have memories of your mom playing guitar?
Yeah, my mom took lessons. I guess she would have been in her, like, early 30s, and so I remember watching her play, and I actually started to play the coronet, you know, like the trumpet, and then the piano for a few years, actually took lessons and stuff, and kind of gained an appreciation for creating music, and eventually started playing the bass in the late 70s.
Larry on vocals and guitar.
My grandfather, interestingly enough, was in it. Was a harmonica player. He used to play for. They used to play live on WLS radio way back in the 30s and late 20s and 30s. But you know, would I say that really influenced me? No, I mean, he used to play around with his harmonicas when we were kids and stuff. But I guess it maybe was in my blood from him. But that'd be about it. None of my immediate family were really musicians or anything like that. I loved music, though, all growing up. I, you know, it was really a big part of my life.
Vince on vocals and guitar.
My grandfather played the drums, and he had a little band combo that he played in. That must have influenced my dad, who also played the drums. And as a kid, I remember my dad buying me my first toy drum kit for Christmas. I don't remember it, but I've seen it in the videos. And there's also a baby picture of me, less than a year old, laying on a blanket, and my dad had stuck a couple drumsticks in my hand. And I actually play the drums now. In previous bands, I played the guitar. But yeah, and my dad was also a theater teacher, so he was into music quite a bit.
And here is Larry with track 2, I Came For You.
I Came For You probably comes from, several instances. And that particular I Came For You was about this girl that I had kind of fallen for, and she didn't want to have anything to do with me, and it was kind of tough digesting all that. So basically, it's a sad love, it's a love story that went awry. It was the first time in my life, I think, that I really fell for a girl, and she really wasn't having anything to do with me other than friendship. So that was a little tough one.
You might have different ways of working on it, but did your songs just sort of pour out, or did you tend to work on them a long time, or were they more inspirational and they just came out?
Yeah, I think you come up with the chords, or I do anyway. I come up with the chords, and then really kind of a phrase will jump into your mind. or something will kind of set that the mood for that song, and then you build off of that phrase pretty much. That's how I've always done it anyway. You know, the song pretty much dictates the mood that comes out of you, and then that translates into the lyrics.
Was there a difference between music that was inspirational to you as just liking music and music that would actually cause you to go out and think you could be in a band?
Yeah, I mean, I was always into, you know, as typical kid growing up in the 70s and early 80s, I started out the typical rock stuff you heard on the radio, you know, Zeppelin and all that type of stuff. I wanna tell you about the girl I know. My, she looks so fine. And of course, you're like way into that. It wasn't until I got introduced to punk rock actually that it dawns on you that you can actually go out and be in a band and play in front of live crowds, really. So it really was more the punk rock music that influenced me to actually play.
I've always had a very eclectic musical taste, and it just, music has to speak to me, you know, whether it's Miles Davis or Led Zeppelin. It's just something that you feel. And so I would say I was influenced by a lot of different things, but just something about playing like fast, loud guitar rock is just a lot. It's just pure energy, and I think out of any music I've ever played, that I keep going back to that.
I always loved music, and you know, it just always got me going. You know, rock music, and I like to watch performers. I think the first rock concert I ever went to was Emerson, Lake and Palmer. He had white horses. And I must have been probably 1978 or 1979. And since I was still in grade school at the time, my mom insisted that she come with, which was kind of a trip, me and two buddies and my mom at a rock concert in the 70s at the International Amphitheater on Chicago's South Side. I don't know if it was, a little bit of my dad's theater background that rubbed off on me as far as wanting to perform, but I always kind of had that drive to perform.
Well, at the time I was taking drum lessons. I played in the high school band also. I think what really happened was like to listen to rock and roll and, you know, set up the old stereo and my drum set upstairs in my parents' house and started playing and having friends come over and jam. I went to kindergarten with Vince Marine, and so I've known him quite a long time.
I went to grade school with Dave, and we were in the grade school concert band together, and also the high school band, so I knew them all through high school. But we never really played in a group setting until, I believe it was after we graduated, I went to ISU for a year and met Larry DeMore down there by chance, who I didn't know he was going to that school, and we really didn't hang around that much in high school, although we were both on the wrestling team. And we started playing in the basement of the dorm, just getting together and making some noise.
I don't know if I ever knew that you guys were on wrestling together. Me and Ben were on wrestling team together, too. I just thought that's
interesting. Oh, really?
Yeah. Wrestlers becoming punks. Vince
lived in the same dorm room I did, and pretty much, basically, we smoked a lot of pot together in those days, and he played guitar, and I played guitar, so we used to sit around and play guitar together, really. So when we got out of college, or when I flunked out of college, we wanted to keep playing, so we brought in Dave, and then I met Steve through them. I don't even, to be honest with you, I met Steve through them, and I don't really even know how they knew Steve before.
I had known Vince through a friend, and this friend had tried out for Vince's project playing bass, but she wasn't very good, so she sort of suggested that I get together with these guys, and so I did, and it felt right.
We started, and then Larry was kind of looking for something to do, and that's when we started jamming in a cover band called Blue Youth. We actually have recordings of that, too, and it sounds pretty good.
Here's Vince with track 3, No Future.
you know, I think every punk band had to have a song that the theme was no future. One verse is kind of about a relationship with a particular girl and not having a future. The other verse is about not having prospects for employment. And it was the 80s, so unemployment was pretty high. And even though we were somewhat privileged suburban kids, we still worried quite a bit about what the future was going to hold for us.
The story was an American and a Russian arguing about their two countries. And the American said, look, in my country, I can walk into the Oval Office, I can pound the president's desk and say, Mr. President, I don't like the way you're running our country. And the Russian said, I can do that. The American said, you can? He says, yes. I can go into the Kremlin, to the General Secretary's office, pound his desk and say, Mr. General Secretary, I don't like the way President Reagan's running his country.
Larry, were you in any bands prior to Bhopal Stiffs?
Shortly before Bhopal, I had, right out of school, I had gotten into a band with what ended up to be, well, really all of us. A few covers and they're a little more new wave-ish before we got into Bhopal Stiffs.
David and Vince still have recordings of that band. It was called Blue Youth.
Oh my God! I gotta believe it's horrible. You know, it was a lot of like early '80s new wave covers. I think it's some really cheesy stuff back then, and that's really when I was starting getting into punk rock, and then my whole idea of what I wanted to do changed at that point.
What was the punk rock band that pushed it over the edge for you?
And you remember the old on TV, that closed circuit television before cable TV? Do you remember that at all?
Yeah, and on the TV it would come out all staticky, but if you tried to switch the knob of the channel thing very quickly, you can actually see a little bit for a little while.
Exactly. So my parents had that, and I was watching it one night, and this really creepy documentary about punk rock music came on. It was called, it's pretty famous now, Decline of a Western Civilization. I kind of watched that in awe, and it was kind of scary to me, but something drew me to it. I was really taken in by it. And I would say probably it wasn't even a month after I saw that. I just happened to be driving in my car and, going through the dial on my radio, and I hooked into this old college radio station from Northwestern, WNUR. Two songs I heard back-to-back were Naked Raygun's I Lie, followed by a Minor Threat song, Filler. And those two songs just so blew me away that from there on out, I just got sucked in completely after that. I mean, it changed that quick for me.
WNUR was a big influence on a lot of us that lived out in the suburbs.
It was. I mean, it was really one of like two college stations that were playing a lot of punk rock at the time. And if you adjusted your aerial just right on the radio, you know, most of the suburban kids and the outlying areas of Chicago could get it. So, and I think a lot of people in those days got a lot of their musical taste from those stations.
Vince, it seems obvious to me that you were driven to be a band creating original material instead of just being a cover band. So when you decided not to be a cover band anymore, how did you come up with the name Bhopal Stiffs?
We were, you know, kind of emulating the Dead Kennedys, where we wanted to go for kind of shock value. We were also looking towards current events. We initially, I think before Bhopal Stiffs, someone mentioned the Shuttle Stiffs, but we thought that would be a little too unpopular, maybe too soon after that shuttle disaster. So I don't know. We decided that one probably wouldn't fly. So we settled on the Bhopal, which was an even greater disaster.
Vince, track 4, I Don't Care.
I Don't Care is basically just a teen angst type of song, although we were in our early 20s. But, you know, it's your, I think we're trying to encapsulate the punk rock ethos at the time. And it also had to do with relationships not going well and relationships with the opposite sex and just kind of giving up.
Batteries Not Included was a 21 and over club on Clybourne in Chicago's North Side. It booked local bands from around 1984 to 1995. Larry, what do you remember of this club?
It was just a small club that many, many local bands played at, and a, you know, really great place to play, and again, a great place to see a lot of local live acts.
Sometimes we just played for each other's bands. It was a trial by fire, from what I remember.
Oh, it was definitely. And, but between the bands that were playing and, you know, your guys' friends came out, our guys' friends came out, the other band's guys' friends came out, and, you know, they ended up, it was a small room, so it ended up being okay.
Steve, what do you have to say about Batteries Not Included?
Not Included was a little hole-in-the-wall place that's long gone, and they had a room in the back where they would have these shows that, I don't know how many people you could fit in the room, not that many, but pretty intimate little place, and so we had shows there for maybe a year or so, and that's how we met Screeching Weasel face-to-face, and I think we had been talking to you guys for a little while, and trying to get you to come out. So I still have very fond memories of that show. But yeah, we had a lot of great shows there. Maybe a lot would be a half a dozen at the most, I would say, but it seemed like a lot because of all the wacky things that would happen.
I honestly don't, Steve, feel like that place is more about these great, weird, bizarre memories than actually like any advancing of the band. I hardly recall people besides the band and a few other fans seeing those shows. My memories are more about having met other bands that I ended up being friends with for like years. I always felt like we were playing like at 1 a.m. or it was always so late.
Yeah, I think that's why nobody ever really got paid, because we were just performing for ourselves, you know? I do recollect that, but it didn't matter because, you know, we felt like we were just going to have a good time and it didn't matter. And to have other bands appreciate what you do made it all worthwhile.
Batteries Not Included was booked by Jim Ellison during the mid to late 80s. He booked Screeching Weasel and the Bhopal Stiffs in the summer of 1986. Jim was the frontman for the band Material Issue, who would later go on to some recognition with their songs Diane and Valerie Loves Me. Valerie Loves Me was the impetus for the Screeching Weasel song Veronica Hates Me. Jim Ellison tragically died in 1986 of carbon monoxide poisoning in his garage. Larry, track 5, Not Just My Head.
Not Just My Head, I think, is a little bit more of a political song, pretty typical of the punk rock that was happening back in those days, just against society.
Did you feel that was a direction that, once again, it just came out of you, or did you make a concerted effort to try to have some sort of socio-political...
No, I think again, that the lyrics just kind of come out of you. You know, when you're 23, 24, I think you become a little more politically aware, and I think the punk rock, it was political, and it's kind of like you're coming of age through the music, you know, and of course you have something to say about it once you really kind of start following politics on it on a daily basis.
The Iran-Contra hearings this week included testimony by several witnesses, all of whom continued to incriminate Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North. Here to respond to this testimony is Colonel North's attorney, Mr. Thomas Flanagan, Esquire.
Hello, I'm Tommy Flanagan, and I'm here to tell you that my client, Oliver North, is completely innocent. You know how I know? Because it was me. Yeah, that's the... Isn't that special?
You don't listen to a single word we say. Think you fuck for every day. Fucking arrogance drives me crazy. Get back in your mold and do just what we're told. We crop and change. You think we're crazy. It's not just my head.
Steve, Bhopal became regulars at a bar called The Exit. Can you tell me about this bar and also the band's relation to it?
Yeah, Larry was hanging out at this Northside punk rock club called The Exit, and he was underage at the time, but kind of knew the people at the door and was getting in, and but soon we were all kind of hanging out there and finding new friends, and we knew the manager really well, and whenever he needed a band to play, we would be there to play, so we kind of became the house band pretty quickly.
The Exit was a big part of my growing up, or moving metaphorically. I hadn't moved yet into the city, but that bar was sort of, I think I already knew punk, but that bar sort of helped create the, I don't know, the environment of punk for me. The first Exit, that's the one that I didn't make the transition to the second one. But that first one had a feel to it that I just, me and Matt Nelson would go there every single weekend, you know, dancing or just sitting there. It was a big part of my becoming into the punk scene from the suburbs to the city.
Absolutely. I feel the same way. We had similar experiences, and, you know, hanging out there, strangely enough, I felt pretty normal being there, and it felt good. Maybe because I looked fairly normal compared to a lot of people or whatever, but I felt like I fit in somehow.
Not just my head, not just my head, but I'm done when there's something.
So we were hanging out at Exit before we even had a band together. We used to practice 5 days a week, every night, and we never played out, never played out, never played out, and finally we got the balls to go out and play a show at Exit. So we played that show, and everybody that worked there liked us, so we were already friends with them. So we de facto became like one of the house bands that played at Exit.
We love
well, we really became good friends with Joe Piccolo, who had been managing the bar. So I think that knowing Joe and then the band, I just think the band was a pretty good band. So I think that we just played and people liked us. We hung out there quite a bit. Joe had said that he would pay for a 7-inch release of the first release of the Bhopal Fist, and he did, and it kind of launched us ahead, and then that's when we kept moving forward.
And it's funny because there was almost like a suburban scene blossoming at the same time as well as the city scene. It kind of bridged the gap between the suburban scene that was developing and the city scene. So there was a lot of Exit shows for us, and then jaunts out to the suburbs, you know, for the Dirty Nelly shows and the McGregor shows.
Dirty Nelly's was an Irish bar in the north suburbs in a place called Palatine. Ben booked a show for our band Screeching Weasel at this club, and it went so well that we began booking punk shows at this club on a monthly basis. The local bands had some conflict because, in essence, we were stealing their local hangout. But Ben believed that it was more important to invite touring bands into our suburban world, and conversely, we believed if you wanted to be a band that created original material, you would have to play more than just your local hangout. Bhopal Stiffs was a band that would help to bring good crowds into our little club in the suburbs, and in many ways I feel it validated the club and helped to bridge the gap between the city bands and the isolated suburbs on the varying sides of the city. My friend Matt Nelson took over booking when Ben and I got too busy touring. Matt Nelson named the production company Out of Control after the DJ company the two of us had started in high school. Matt brought the booking agency over to a different club called McGregor's in Elmhurst, which would become the more historically known suburban venue, booking for such beginning bands as SNFU, Green Day, Smoking Popes, Groovy Ghoulies, Mr. T Experience, The Offspring, The Queers, NoFX, Jawbreaker, and many more. Bhopal Stiff and Larry's next band, Pegboy, would always be an inspiration to us.
The next one I have for you, Vince, is Fun at the Beach, which is actually one of my favorites. I remember that seeing that one live. I think it might have been one of the first songs you played when I saw you way, way back. I just love the power of those, that guitar playing on that one.
Oh, thanks. Fun at the Beach was kind of our attempt at kind of a surf type of a song, and we wanted to do something a little more light, most of our stuff was about personal relationships and politics. So that was one of the few songs that was some of them more party type of party songs, and that was our kind of our lighthearted party song. And really liked the Dave's drumming on that. He the little drum intro into it we kind of liked, and also the one of the few songs that actually had some shout out background vocals.
When you were a baby in your crib, your father looked down at you. He had but one hope. Someday my son will grow to be a man. Well, look at you now. You just got your asses whipped by a bunch of goddamn nerds. Nerds! Well, if I was you, I'd do something about it. I would get up and redeem myself in the eyes of my father, my maker, and my coach! Well, let's get those nerds!
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 What are we waiting for?
Many of the songs from Bhopal Stiffs are from a 10-song demo and a following 7-inch, both from a session recorded around 87. Do you have memories of recording that first collection of songs?
Oh yeah, definitely.
That was so fun, to be honest with you. I remember it very well. For some suburban kids, that was a big thing.
Absolutely. We had been playing a lot of shows and rehearsing a lot.
Not so much that we prepared for it. We were practicing probably 5 nights a week. So we were, you know, as far as I was concerned, we were probably one of the tightest bands I've been in, even more so than Tight Boy.
I remember driving down into the city.
And we went into Chicago Recording Company, which was major overkill for a little band like ours to be in a really deluxe place like that.
It's a nice, beautiful studio that's done some gold records, platinum records hanging on the wall.
Another day is gone, I'm still all alone.
And it's just a huge place, and that was recorded by Ian Burgess, who did quite a few of the Chicago punk bands at that time.
Hey, what it's like to be dead, not a thought there to be had.
You know, I had met Ian Burgess through the exit. I think it was kind of his idea. We were talking one night over a beer, and he said, why don't you guys just come in and do a demo? So that's exactly what we did. You know, we were all excited to be working for Ian to begin with. And at the time, he was considered one of the best engineers in all of the punk rock scene.
And I remember John Haggerty was in the studio with us at the time from Naked Ray Gun. And I had this little amp that just wasn't cutting it, so he was kind enough to let us borrow his amp. So he got a nice, beefier sound out of that.
I had known John pretty well at that point, and he was just wanting to get in to start learning how to engineer a little bit. He probably smoked more cigarettes than I actually did anything. But yeah, he sat in for a lot of that session and tweaked the knobs with Ian.
It was really wild being in such a big studio. We'd never been anywhere like that before, where you're separated by glass and the other musician is 30 feet away from you, where we're always used to playing in a basement or in a small club where you can, you know, reach out and touch the guy next to you.
So we just banged out a whole lot of songs, and sometimes, truthfully, you know, the lead wasn't quite right, but we just went with it. And that was a pretty good representation of who we were at the time, I have to say, you know, warts and all.
Songs were one takers. We didn't really have to go over and over and over again to make a record.
It was a really exciting time for us all.
It was definitely a group effort.
It's something that I look back on very fondly of.
Vince on track number 7, the second Head song, One Track Head.
Oh, One Track Head. It's kind of a teen angst type of a song, and Actually, one thing interesting about that is one of the verses was not plagiarized, but it's it's inspired by a Jimi Hendrix line. The second verse I borrowed from Jimi Hendrix, where he says, white-collar conservative walking down the street, pointing your plastic finger at me. And that's kind of encapsulates what the whole song is about, really.
White-collar conservative flashing down the street, pointing their plastic finger at me.
Larry, the songs in this demo stayed songs on a demo for years and years, even though I thought they were definitely good enough to be transitioned into a full-length record. It wouldn't actually surface as a CD until Harmless put it out in 2001. Larry, at the time, why didn't you guys decide to put this out on a record?
There was, you know, there was some talk about it. You know, Joe Patelko, who was the manager of Edgewood at the time, we did end up taking a couple of songs off of that demo and putting a single out. So that was our first vinyl release, was from that those demo tapes. After that, you know, we had met Dave Best, who you guys know, we all met at the same time. He had went and ventured into that Roadkill Records, and we wanted to release that demo stuff, and he was more pressing, you know, the demo was out. He was more interested in having some new music. So basically, we re-recorded some of the demo stuff for that record, and I think maybe added one or two new songs at that point, but that's why it never got released. I mean, it was more that he was pushing to do a different recording than anything else.
Take your daughter out of the day, and I'm just not up in home, like, wait for her to see it, and let's see what kind of shit she's in.
David Best was a local Chicago scenester who had a pretty good job working for the publishing company McGraw-Hill. So he had the funds but lacked the savvy and connections with the punks to get records put out. His younger brother was in a band called Rat Tail Grenadier, which featured the soon-to-be punk producer and engineer Mass Giorgini. Mass had already been in contact with me and Ben. So Mass introduced us, and David Best, Ben, and I joined forces in late 1988. We worked out of David's living room and slept on his floor. He pre-chose the name Roadkill Records, and in December of 1988, we released Screeching Weasel's second and most sold record to date, Boogada Boogada Boogada, which transferred to Lookout Records in 1992 after My Brain Hurts had done so well on Lookout. Roadkill Records would go on to release No Empathy, The Effigies, and of course, the Bhopal Stiffs.
I think it's rather sad. I think it's sad. It's kinda sad. Woohoo! You got a one-track head!
Pay to Play, which actually reminds me of more of a, I only ever experienced that in L.A., the actual idea of paying to play. But what was that song about in our Chicago existence?
That's not about pay to play. Is typically in Chicago that refers to politics, but in that instance, it was referred to a relationship where the song is about a girl that kind of becomes a prostitute and wants to charge me for sex, but that really didn't happen. It was more about the feeling I had that a girl was making me kind of jump through hoops. And so that really what that song was based on.
Steve, Roadkill Records, owned by David Best and run by me and Ben, put out your second vinyl EP. Before this occurred, Vince had been replaced. I talked to him about it, but are you comfortable talking about the events that led to this decision?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, to be honest, it's been so long that I kind of scratch my head like and try to think where our minds were at back then and what would have happened had we kept Vince around. I think there was some friction between Vince and the other members, and Looking back, I think we just kind of made a rash decision to replace him and thereby changing the sound, you know, for sure, and the direction of the band somewhat. You know, something only hindsight gives you, and I'm not sure if it was the right call, you know, but it would have changed things.
David.
You know, I'm really confused about, to this day in my life, whatever did happen to make a lineup change. I really had nothing to do with it and just played drums. And then when the change was done, then I just continued to play drums, and we went to the studio again and CRC and recorded the next record there. But it must have been discussed from the other members or something like that. I just was kind of going along and just playing drums. That's all I was doing. I can't
believe that you do this. Larry.
There were certain personalities in the band that just didn't click. We would go to practice and we would spend more time bickering back and forth like little kids than anything else, you know. And it just got to be such a drag on the band that, you know, the guys just said, you know, hey, Tim or us, and we got to do it. So, and I was kind of along with it. I understood that we were getting to the point where we weren't getting anything accomplished, and it was getting to be more of a headache than anything else to continue the way we were. It was a big decision, and we didn't probably last too long after that, maybe a year or two. But I think it was the right decision in that regard. It was time for us to part ways at that point. You know, Vince is still a great friend of mine. I don't see him all that much anymore, and he's friends with everybody else in the band. Looking back on it, it was petty shit, but that happens with most bands, you know.
Vince.
Personality conflicts, you know, petty stuff that bands argue about. You know, somebody's rushing, somebody criticizes something for something, other guy takes offense, one guy thinks the other guy is siding with somebody else, and his feelings are hurt, and words are said, and, you know, I think I actually flipped a deck of cards at Steve Saylor's. And at that point, Larry said he knew that it was over. Yeah, Tepper got the best of me, and, you know, once something's said, can't be taken back. And I don't blame anybody except myself for that.
The next two tracks you will hear are from the EPA 12-inch put out in 1988 on Roadkill Records, with Vince Marine being replaced by Ron Lowe on guitar. Larry on track 9, Bottle It Up.
Yeah, Bottle It Up. I mean, you can see a lot of our songs, a lot of my songs throughout my life have dealt with mostly personal issues. And I think Bottle It Up was another one of those, you know, you go through times when I suppose you're a little depressed as you're growing up, and, you know, Bottle Up is one of those songs that just kind of addresses that and you know, where you kind of fit yourself up against the world and try to come out of it, you know, halfway sane.
Even though many bands, Joe's Victims of Society, Dan Schaefer's Generation Waste, Ben and my band Screeching Weasel, and Larry, Vince, and David and Steve's band Bhopal Stiffs, even though we live in the suburbs of a fairly established city, there was no internet to hear each other's bands, and venues were hard to book. We relied heavily on discovering each other, often by accident, on local college radio stations. So here is Steve and then Larry on that exact subject.
Well, WZRD was a great radio station. It was hosted by Joe Garza, had a show, and he would have the Bhopal Stiffs play on a pretty regular basis. WNUR had a show called Fast and Loud on Saturday nights, I believe, and we were big fans. and we would tune in, and we would barely be able to get it from Riverside, but we would listen to Fast and Loud, and it really made us want to play Fast and Loud, oddly enough.
Me and Larry talked a little bit about that, and I've also talked about it with Joe of Vindictive, because me and Ben met Joe Vindictive in the station at WNUR on Fast and Loud, and Larry had called.
How I had met you guys, I had heard you guys doing an interview on NUR, and I love Screeching Weasel's music. I love the music that you guys were playing, and I think we had a show coming up at a place called Batteries Not Included. I actually called Rodney from the radio station. He put Ben on the line, and that was my first introduction to you guys.
Oh, wow.
I asked if you guys wanted to play a show with us.
Wow, and we said yes?
Yeah, he said yes, and I think, you know, later on that month we were playing together, and that's how I got to know you guys at all. I mean, really, that's kind of the impact that those radio stations had on everybody. They were actually pretty fundamental in, you know, opening up the scene to all of us.
Larry, track 10, Too Many Things.
Too Many Things, depression. I think depression is a lot, you know, is a pretty much an underlying factor in a lot of my lyrics. You know, you get depressed, and then that song, Too Many Things, is kind of a, you know, it's depressed, you know, it's about depression. But then, again, on the other side, it's telling you to carry on, and there's too many, you know, in other words, there's too many things that you still have to live for than to give up.
So Larry, do you think, I often wonder about this when I do longer writing or even lyrics, do you think the writing of thoughts in your head, you know, like, releases some of the demons in some ways, or even performing the song, or do you think it's therapeutic in any ways?
I think a lot of my writing relates to a lot of my demons. You know, not so much in a bad way, but they're almost therapeutic. I mean, this, you like to, you know, when I write lyrics anyway, you like to dig down deep and get to the real crust that's buried inside of you. And a lot of times that has to do with being, you know, disillusioned or depressed, or, you know, that's where a lot of your inspiration comes from, I believe, or mine did anyway. You know, it's kind of, I think it's good to dig down and find some of that stuff that you don't really, that doesn't really sit with you very well. I mean, for me, it inspires me a little bit more than singing about happy stuff. And for two, like I said, it is pretty therapeutic to talk about that stuff.
Yeah, I think I've realized actually as I sometimes reflect back on what I've written, that it actually has helped me navigate through my life, even accidental sometimes. It's like, oh, I didn't even know I was writing about that, and I won't do that again.
Yeah, that's totally true, and you know, I think through my whole career that's been the case with me. I mean, I've always written about personal, you know, personal stuff, even if it's something that's not direct, at least it's a personal feeling that you have or something that's directing you to write that stuff.
It resulted, as a matter of fact, in Brown assaulting his wife with a lead pipe and firing a gun at a car that she was in. These are charges that Brown denies. He was released yesterday on $15,000 bond. He joins us from Atlanta to discuss the charges, and we welcome you, James Brown. How did all of this trouble begin?
Living in America. Something wrong.
Nothing wrong at all. You're not in any difficulty, but you're out on bond.
No, I'm not.
Have all the charges been dropped?
Yeah, I'm out on love.
Well, are you out on love or out of love? Which is it?
Out on love. Alone from night to night, you find me.
Now, James, this isn't the first time you and your wife have had a problem. Are the two of you going to be able to work this out?
Let's talk about some music.
Vince departed sometime in 1988, and Ron Lowe took over. Not too much later, sometime in 89, the band broke up. Now here are Steve, Larry, and David talking about the breakup of the band and the forming of Pegboy.
You know, that's something that I think everyone would agree. It just went out with a with a whimper.
We brought Ron on. To be honest with you, we were kind of losing a little bit of steam after Vince left.
We never planned on just kind of giving up, but it just happened that way. And we had a few new songs that probably should have been officially recorded, but just never were. And we just, Larry and I kind of started doing other things, you know. Larry first, his head was in a different place or something by then.
I know. I remember what happened at the time. Me and Steve were renting a house in Brookfield, Illinois, and we used to practice there, and then it just kind of fizzled away. And then I noticed that Larry seemed to be uninterested, but I think that he met some other musicians, and it was John Hegarty.
Actually, there was probably two or three months where, you know, nothing really was going on, and Larry and John had been getting together with maybe another bass player or something, and eventually when we got together, you know, it sounded pretty good and it was fun and fresh.
John Hegarty at that point had just quit Naked Ray Gun, and he had actually came to practice with us a couple times, but said he told me, he's like, you know, he said, I don't want to really join you guys. He said, but if you're ever going to do anything else, give me a call. So that kind of passed. But like I said, at the same time, our steam was kind of running out. It was just got to be, how do you say, it just got to be kind of a drag to have to go to practice and everything. And when you're feeling like that, you just want to move on and try something new. And at that point, John had called me and asked if I wanted to get a band together. So I took the jump.
So John came over and played guitar, and I played drum. And then, well, it's no hard feelings, but he wanted to play with his brother on drums, Joey. And that's how Pegboy kind of started. I was actually the first drummer in Pegboy.
I think what you said, it makes sense. The brothers are tight-knit. It makes sense that he wanted to have his brother playing.
I think that's exactly what happened. It did. And then John actually called me and said that he knew of a couple other bands that are looking for a drummer. And at the time, I had found Rob Romalski, the lead for Buzz Muscle, with Brian Gay. He used to be in Government Issue, and Greg Dunlap.
In case you couldn't understand the quality of the recording, David joined the band Buzz Muscle with Brian Gay from Government Issue, Rob Wormoski from Defoliants, and Greg Dunlap, the founder of a Chicago fanzine called This.
As the progression of the band sounded, I gotta say, once Vince left, sounded more and more closer to like Naked Ray Gun. So it made sense that Larry was moving more towards wanting to work with the brothers and sort of nurturing that sound more. David went on to say that Pegboy recorded two songs that were previously written by Bhopal Stiffs, one of them being My Youth. This final track is the last recording that the Bhopal Stiffs would do as a band. It was for a 7-inch called There's a Fungus Among Us, released in 1989. There was a lot of bands on this one 7-inch. The Vermicious Canids, Gear, Only the Strong, No Empathy, Target, and Screeching Weasel. Now here is Larry with the last track, track 11, Too Much Pain.
And speaking about personal feelings, Too Much Pain is the last one I have here.
Again, you know, again, it's another song about depression. I think, you know, there was probably 5-6 years of my life that, you know, probably the biggest feeling I had was depression. So, you know, again, that was a song about just feeling overwhelmed with bad feelings. Just, you know, I don't really know what to say about those. But it seems to be a recurring. topic with me.
Just curious, just quick with Bhopal and with Pegboy, did you kind of just walk in with fully worked out songs, and for the most part?
No, you know, I mean, the way I write, I would come in with maybe a part, or maybe a verse musically and a chorus, and maybe some lyrics, or maybe just a melody.
And then pretty much let everybody else kind of do their own thing around that. So I would come in with like the basis of a song and let pretty much everybody else kind of come up with their own parts to it or their own drums or you know, bass riffs and everything else. And just kind of let the thing come together between all of us.
Yeah, because I just wonder sometimes if the, this has happened to me, where the hearing it live with the actual band filling it in sort of changes the mood of the song and maybe you've changed some lyrics here or there or add.
Oh, definitely. I think, that's why in a lot of cases, any of the bands I've been in with, even if it was maybe an idea that I came up with or something, we typically give credit to everybody for writing it because everybody puts their two cents in and makes it what it is.
Good evening, everyone. From the west side of the Berlin Wall at the Brandenburg Gate, I'm Tom Brokaw. The Brandenburg Gate, of course, is in East Berlin, and the sound that you hear and what you're seeing tonight, not hammers and sickles, but hammers and chisels as young people take down this wall bit by bit.
Now I'm going to jump years into the future. Steve, tell us some stories about what led to the reunion shows. How did those come about?
Well, actually, in 2001, we had a great show at the Fireside Bowl, and that was actually the major player, and that was a guy named Scott Thompson, who was putting together a compilation, and he was a fan, and he's about 10 years younger than me or so, but he just always wanted to do a compilation, and he wanted to do a Stiff compilation, and that probably never would have happened without him and all of his work. And so we did a show and with all of the original members plus Ron, and somehow it came together and we had a really, really good time. So that was 2001.
You had both Ron and Vince for that first reunion.
We did, and it actually, it worked out just fine, and it was a big sound, but it was a little complicated, you know, because Vince had never played Ron songs, and we had stopped doing certain Vince songs after Ron got in, so a little bit of work. It was a lot of fun, but, you know, it would be another 9 years before we'd all get together again and do something else. The one in 2010, that was at a place called the Subterranean in Wicker Park, and actually that one came together surprisingly well after what we went through, because it had been a while since Vince had played and since Dave had played drums, and Larry was kind of rusty, and so it took a little bit of work, but we got it together, and I actually was just listening to a recording of those rehearsal sessions, and they're not bad at all, I have to say. Sadly, I don't know that it'll ever happen again.
And I try some way tomorrow, today, when I feel the pain too much to take.
Now here is Vince, then Larry, to bring it to a closing.
You know, there's an interesting story. When we did that Riot Fest reunion, Dave had moved to Colorado and he was playing bass. He'd been playing bass in a couple bands. And we told him about this reunion show, and he's like, oh, yeah, no problem. You know, he had to get his drum kit out of storage or something. And he's like, no problem. And we're all working on the songs, you know, listening to them, practicing a little bit, although I don't know how much listening and practicing Larry did. That's not his style. But when Dave got out here and we had our first practice, he sat down at the drum kit, and he couldn't remember anything. And it was like we're really almost in panic mode. That how are we going to do this? He really doesn't seem to remember really how to even play the drums. And he came only like 3 days before the show. He flew out here. So I said, all right, here's what we're going to do. Dave, you're coming. You're staying with me, coming out to my house, and we're just going to do an intense session. And I had the drum kit at my house, and we're just going to listen to the music, and we're going to work everything through. And we got 3 days, and you know, we'll be ready. And so that's what we did, and he pulled it off. But it was kind of scary at first.
Really nothing more than we were asked twice, and we did it twice. The last one was a disaster, so I don't think it'll happen anymore.
This seems a strange ending, almost cynical in some ways. But the Bhopal Stiffs had an effect on me and on the Chicago underground punk scene that can't be explained quite well enough in a contemporary setting. So I thought it both humorous and both fitting that to try to recapture that experience was futile, although admirable. Thank you for listening to episode 17 featuring the Bhopal Stiffs. Stay tuned for the next episode featuring all four members of the Promise Ring during the 1997 Jade Tree Records release of Nothing Feels Good. Me in Japan saying goodbye to you wherever you happen to be. See you soon. Hear you soon. Hear me soon.
Johnny's got a problem and he's out of control. Johnny's got a problem and he's out of control now.
Thank you for listening to Jughead's Basement here on the all-new JugheadsBasement.com. If you'd like to help keep Jughead's Basement free every month, click the donate button and give as much or as little as you can. The show is also available on iTunes, so take a moment and write us a review. We'll see you next month.